I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, Mormon Mitt Romney says he'll deliver a speech on his faith this week as polls show he's losing in Iowa to avowed Christian Mike Huckabee. Well, is Romney the victim of a modern-day witch hunt, or did he bring scrutiny upon himself by courting the Christian vote? But first, in a stunning result, voters in Venezuela turned down a proposed overhaul to their constitution that would have granted their president, Hugo Chavez, sweeping new powers. Well, the margin was narrow. It was surprising, given that Chavez and his supporters dominate all the levers of power there. Simone Romero is Andean bureau chief for the New York Times in Caracas. Simone, South America watchers say these stunning developments will have implications for the whole hemisphere. Remind us why.
Well, Chavez has adopted an incredibly assertive foreign policy throughout the region, especially here in the Andes, where he has allies and governments in Bolivia and in Ecuador, also in parts of the Caribbean and in Central America, Nicaragua, and of course in Cuba. So he's showered some of those allies with funding and financing, and they're also trying to push through reforms that are somewhat inspired by his own here, by his own proposals in Venezuela. So it's going to be very interesting to see how this plays out in those places.
Right. And tell us exactly what it is that the voters turned down.
The voters here in Venezuela turned down 69 proposed amendments to the Constitution. One measure, for example, would have abolished Chavez's term limits. Another would have extended his term to 7 years from six. Another would have raised the threshold for recalling him from office. There were also some items in there that were welcomed by both his supporters and his critics. Some of them would have prohibited discrimination based on political beliefs or sexual orientation. There was also an item in there that would have created a pension system for the poor, for the informal workers, of course. And so it was really a huge overhaul of the Constitution. And one thing that emerged that was clear was that Chavez was essentially taking his supporters, even some of the most loyal ones, just to a place where they weren't quite ready to go.
There's also been some international disputes. A couple of weeks ago, Spain's king publicly told Chavez to shut up. He had a spat recently with Colombian President Uribe, who stopped Chavez's mediation. He was mediating between the Colombian government and Colombia's Marxist rebels to release some hostages. Is it your sense that that played into it, that voters maybe in Venezuela felt a little more free to say no to Chavez? Or, you know, why did they turn down his proposals?
There was certainly a greater awareness of Chavez's increasingly sort of erratic behavior in international relations here in recent weeks. You saw T-shirts on the streets of Caracas popping up that reproduce the Spanish king's comments. There's also a very large Colombian immigrant community here in Venezuela, some of whom were not happy with the president's antagonistic relationship with the Colombian government. So in a sense, yes, many voters here were emboldened to vote against it, but a lot of them, you know, just took a close look as well at many of the reforms and just decided that what was in there wasn't for them.
Yeah. So what is the mood in Venezuela today?
Well, the situation on the streets here is really amazing. It depends what part of the country you're in, of course. In opposition strongholds, in which are generally more prosperous areas, there's a mood of euphoria. There were celebrations. Hundreds of students went out into the streets in the early hours of Monday morning. They were sipping from bottles of rum and jumping up and down and chanting and shooting fireworks into the air. And on the other hand, in areas where Chavez's loyal followers are concentrated, there was a lot of clearly sadness and despondence and surprise at the outcome. There was a decent-sized crowd that had gathered in front of the presidential palace last night to await the results, and they were actually waiting also for Chavez to speak to them. And when it became clear that the outcome wasn't going to happen the way that they expected, there was a lot of sadness.
Yeah, because they embrace Hugo Chavez's socialist moves as something that will benefit them. Well, you said that this is going to reverberate in the region, but in the meantime, what about the short term? What does this mean for Chavez's reign as president, for instance?
Well, we have to remember that Chavez has 5 years left in his term in Venezuela. He and his supporters actually—they still control the Supreme Court, the National Assembly, the National Oil Company, almost every state government, the entire federal bureaucracy. So, he's still in a position of incredible strength to move his project forward. He says, of course, that they're going to take a moment now and pause and look back at what happened in the past few weeks and what flaws may have been implemented. But he still clearly wants to move ahead.
And what else has he said about his defeat?
Well, he was quite cordial last night. He congratulated his adversaries in nationally broadcast comments. But he also said that for now they're going to hold back, but he still wants to move ahead with this project.
Simón Romero is Andean bureau chief for the New York Times. He's speaking to us from Caracas. Simón, thanks so much.
Robin, it's been a pleasure. Thanks very much.
Republican presidential candidate Mitt Romney said today he's going to deliver a speech on his Mormon faith this week because voters in Iowa want to know more about it.
Times have changed, and particularly in a state like Iowa, there's been interest about religion generally, and I think religion does have a very important role in our society, and therefore it's important to talk about our religious heritage.
Romney speaking today on Boston's WBZ Radio. Well, his decision to make the speech follows months of debate within the Romney campaign and reflects the surging candidacy of former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee. Huckabee, a former Baptist preacher, defines himself explicitly as a Christian leader and has jumped to a slight lead over Romney in Iowa polls, despite the fact that Romney has spent millions in the state, Huckabee about $300,000. The historical precedent for Romney's speech is John F. Kennedy's address to the Greater Houston Ministerial Association on September 12, 1960. This was when Kennedy was running for president against Richard Nixon, and Americans had questions about Kennedy's Catholicism.
I believe in an America that is officially neither Catholic, Protestant, nor Jewish, where no public official either requests or accepts instructions on public policy from the Pope, the National Council of Churches, or any other ecclesiastical source.
Mitt Romney, the former governor of Massachusetts, will also speak in Texas this week at the George Bush Presidential Library and Museum in College Station. Well, will his be another historic moment in American politics? And why does this all matter? Alan Wolf is director of the Boise Center for Religion and Politics at Boston College. He joins us now. Professor Wolf, it would seem, you know, Kennedy's challenge in the 60s was offsetting concerns that he would take direction from the Pope. And we're going to hear in a moment about the leadership structure of the Mormon Church, but it seems at the outset that Romney has perhaps additional perceptions to overcome.
Yeah, Mitt Romney's in a very, very different situation than John F. Kennedy. John F. Kennedy essentially gave an anti-Catholic speech. He essentially said, look, I'm a Catholic, but that's not relevant. You shouldn't really consider that in determining who you're going to vote for. Mitt Romney can't say that.
Because?
Because starting in 1984, the Republican Party adopted a religious test for office. Now, Article 6 of the U.S. Constitution says that there should be no religious tests for office, but it doesn't prevent a political party from saying that if you're going to get our nomination, you've got to pass a religious quiz. And that's what the Republican Party has essentially done. It has said, we will not give you our nomination unless you satisfy us that you have particular kinds of religious beliefs. And those religious beliefs are primarily evangelical and not Mormon.
Well,
that's Romney's problem.
And this is primarily the core of the Republican Party. And, you know, some might say they have the right to set up that standard, but live by the sword, die by the sword, because, as you and others have said, if Mitt Romney now makes a speech saying, as Kennedy did, that there is a firewall between church and state, this core group will bristle at that.
They will. They will. And if he says, hey, you know, I'm a Mormon and this is what I believe, they're going to bristle at that because some 30-35% of American evangelicals say they would never vote for a Mormon under any circumstances. But then the final problem is if he says, I believe in a born-again Jesus the way you evangelicals do, they're not going to be persuaded by that either because they know it's not going to be true.
Well, let's remind ourselves of what's happened in the last couple of weeks that's added so much heat to this debate. Last week during the Republican presidential debate, Romney was asked if he believes every word in the Bible. He said, quoting, I might interpret the word differently than you interpret the word, but I read the Bible and I believe the Bible is the word of God. The next day, there was a flurry of articles that quoted the LDS.org official website of the Mormon Church saying, as the Bible was compiled, organized, translated, and transcribed, many errors entered the text. And then, according to the website, they go on to say that Mormons revere and study Mormon texts in addition to the flawed Bible, texts like the Book of Mormon, the Doctrine and Covenants, the Pearl of Great Price, and the words of modern prophets. That seemed to be the first time many Christians really heard that differentiation.
Well, that you know, Mitt Romney already has a political problem. He's seen as a flip-flopper. He changes positions depending upon what time of the year it is, more or less. Now he's got a religious problem because, in fact, he did say something that his church doesn't believe in, and that really is a problem. And by the way, Robin, in addition, Mike Huckabee, who's now his main rival and who's an evangelical and is supposed to believe that the Bible is the literal word of God, followed Romney's statement by saying he didn't accept every word in the Bible as a literal word.
I think was it him? It might have been him who said, the whole Jonah and the whale thing I'm not so sure about.
Right, exactly.
Well, but see, the focus has not been on Huckabee, who has been campaigning as a Christian leader, which might have, drawn more attention in other times. But the focus has been on Mitt Romney. What could he have done? Could he have said, and might he still say, you had some thoughts on this, there are differences in my faith, but I'm a deeply religious person.
We've had other examples of people who could do that. Joe Lieberman never pretended to be a Christian. And, even though we have a history of anti-Semitism in this country, I think most Christians listened to him and said, oh, that's what an Orthodox Jew is. He's an Orthodox Jew. He's a man of faith. That's okay. I see the only thing that Romney could do is say, I'm a Mormon. I'm a sixth-generation Mormon. This is what our church stands for. This is what I believe. And I hope that there'll be a great deal of tolerance for that. I think his advisors know, however, that lots of Southern Baptists in this country, from the minute they first go to Sunday school, are told that the Mormon church is not Christian, that it's a cult, and that if he were to acknowledge what he really is, he would simply arouse the kind of fury of potential anti-Mormonism out there in Evangelica. Just give a name to that part of the Republican Party.
And Alan Wolf, what would you say to those who are saying, geez, the fact that you're even discussing this is unfair? Now, I should point out Clayton Christensen, mm-hmm. who's a Harvard Business School professor and a Romney supporter who holds a leadership position in the Mormon Church, told the Boston Globe today that he's delighted that Romney's going to speak about the faith because many Mormons have been a little unsettled about how their faith is being portrayed during a heated political campaign. And he says the speech is going to help Americans understand what the Mormon faith really is. But, there are people saying he shouldn't have to. Mm-hmm. He shouldn't have to give any speech. He shouldn't have to say anything. Your thoughts on that?
Well, he shouldn't. But his father didn't. Harry Reid is a Mormon and a Democrat. If you were running for president, he probably wouldn't. But, Romney is just in this political party that has just made religion so unbelievably important. It's injected it into the public sphere in a way that Romney can't avoid. I personally agree with Clayton Christensen. I think it is unfair to Romney. I think there are forces of religious prejudice out there in the country. They just happen to be concentrated in those places in the Republican Party that you've got to pass through to get the Republican nomination.
Alan Wolf, director of the Boise Center for Religion and American Public Life at Boston College. Professor Wolf, thanks as always.
Thank you, Rob.
Well, later in the week, we'll get a closer look at the Romney speech with a Mormon scholar. But up next, an author who spent 2 years teaching at Brigham Young, who says Romney brought this scrutiny on himself by seeking out the Christian right. That's in 1 minute. Later in the show, a scientist headed for the Bali Global Warming Conference stops by our studio first. Back in 1 minute, here and now. We're continuing our conversation about faith and politics in the 2008 presidential campaign. Today, Republican presidential candidate Mitt Romney said he'd make a speech this Thursday about religious liberty and how his Mormon faith would affect his presidency if elected. Well, earlier this year, we spoke with Damon Linker. Linker is a non-Mormon who spent 2 years as a visiting professor at Brigham Young University, which is owned by the Mormon Church. He later wrote in the New Republic about the challenges a Mormon candidate would face in the U.S. Linker wrote that the more Americans educate themselves about Mormon theology, the more their concerns about a Mormon president will increase. Well, here's an excerpt from our interview. You write, one of the main issues for Romney will be that unlike the Pope, who's not considered a prophet, but someone who's moved by the Spirit, the leaders of the Mormon Church, from Joseph Smith through Brigham Young down to the current leader, Gordon Hinckley, are considered prophets, Why is that important to you in this context?
It's true that all the monotheistic religions believe that their faiths are founded in prophecy, but all of them believe that the age of prophecy is past. Mormonism is different because it was founded by a prophet less than 200 years ago, and the Mormon Church has institutionalized prophecy because they have chosen to make the president of the Mormon Church a prophet by virtue of that office. So anyone who holds the position as president of the church is thought to be God's mouthpiece on earth.
Well, and you have concerns about that, maybe mouthpiece directly to the future president of the United States. But Richard Bushman, a Mormon historian, responded to your article and said it doesn't work like that. It's more like American law, that a judge could possibly throw out everything from the past, say segregation is a case of law. But most of the time, they just build on what already exists. And Bushman said prophets do the same. They just build on already existing prophecies, maybe add to them. And in fact, you even write that some of the most recent prophecies have moderated the church, getting rid of polygamy in the late 1800s and allowing blacks to become members of the church in the 1970s.
Yes, absolutely. That's true that since the death of Joseph Smith, prophecies by the head of the church have tended to be moderate and to bring the church into greater conformity with the American mainstream. It's also true, however, that if you take religion seriously as a practice that human beings have in devotion to the divine, then it is striking that Mormonism is distinct in its tendency to see religious authority coming from someone who is expected to speak with the authority of God himself. You can say all you want that over the last 180 years or so, the Mormon prophet hasn't done anything too far out. But the fact is that less than 200 years ago, this man named Joseph Smith created this religion out of nothingness. He came up with a huge litany of revelations that no one had ever heard of before, claims about empirical history that no one had made previously, and asserted them, and you got this religion created, again, out of nothingness. And that shows that for the Mormons, prophecy is extremely important, and it's not possible to prejudge.
Let's talk about that. Founder Joseph Smith said that the angel Moroni told him where to find these tablets in upstate New York. He translated them. And this is the second major part of the point that you're trying to make. Joseph Smith said that the U.S. is part of sacred history. These are your words, sacred history, that the Garden of Eden was located in Missouri, for instance. In fact, the U.S. was created to allow the restoration to occur and the Mormon Church to spread a restored gospel. I mean, have I interpreted your words correctly?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, what would be the problem with the U.S. being the focal point of some sort of future for Mormonism? How do you read that?
The Mormons believe that we are living, broadly speaking, toward the end of sacred history, shortly before the second coming of Christ. And they have a very literal view of Jesus Christ's return. They believe not only, like many evangelicals and Catholics, that when Christ returns, he'll do so in the Middle East. They believe that he might also come and rule the world from the territory of the United States. Now, maybe in the abstract that isn't a problem, but when you think that there might be a Mormon president sometime in the near future who might believe these things, it I think should raise very interesting questions and perhaps troubling questions about what would happen if some faction of the Mormon Church became convinced that Christ had already returned and was living in Missouri, for instance. Would Romney dismiss this, or is this something that he'd have to take very seriously? And really, if you think about it, if you're a devout believer in this, and this prophet says to do X, no matter how outlandish it might sound, who are you to say no? And again, then I think it's legitimate to ask someone running for president from this church, Mitt Romney, in this case, to say, okay, well, what would you do? And if you're going to tell me that you wouldn't obey such a command, on what basis wouldn't you obey the command? Are you not a devout believer in what your church teaches? What sources does your church have? Is it conscience? Is it that you receive your own different revelation?
Because you write that that Mormons don't have the traditions that other churches have to have branches that might have dissent.
Yes. I mean, for instance, Catholics have natural law that a pious Catholic can use to reflect on something the Pope might say and say, well, this can't be genuinely what God wants because it conflicts with natural law. And you know, that doesn't settle things, but at least it's a tradition of dialectic and discussion and kind of self-criticism on the part of believers. Mormons, at least as yet, have not developed such a tradition.
Well, meanwhile, as you well know, some listeners are cringing. You know, religion is private. All faiths have elements that are inexplicable to people outside churches. As you yourself write, the Constitution stipulates that no religious test shall ever be required to any office under the United States. What do you say to people who say, just even in talking about this, you know, we're violating something sacred?
The reason why Romney has to confront these questions is not so much because he's a Mormon as because he's trying to run as a candidate of the religious right. So if he could be like JFK and say, look, yes, I believe certain things that my church tells me to believe, but that doesn't matter because when I become president, my duties that are incumbent upon me in my office as president will supersede or override what my church might say. That would be fine. But he can't really say this because he's running as a Republican who wants to get the votes of the religious right. And the religious right then would say, well, then you're not one of us. Well, I would say that it's the religious right that wants religion to be at the core of our politics. Well, if that's true, then we as citizens are every bit entitled to ask tough, pointed questions about the faith of our politicians.
Damon Linker spent 2 years teaching at Brigham Young University. He's also author of The Theocons, Secular America Under Siege. We spoke earlier this year. Mitt Romney will speak about his Mormon faith this Thursday. Well, still to come, filmmaker Jay Craven gets the big stars to come to him up in Maine. After the news, here and now. Thousands of representatives from nearly 200 countries are in Bali, Indonesia this week to map out future strategies to combat global warming, and they are working on something of a deadline. They have to come up with a replacement for the Kyoto Protocol, the 1997 treaty that set mandatory limits on emissions for the three dozen industrialized countries that ratified it. It runs out in 2012. They also have to figure out a way to get developing nations like China, India, and Indonesia to play a bigger role in curbing their growing emissions of greenhouse gases. And they have to do this while the U.S. government is still not on board for an international commitment. Well, joining us to talk about what's next, Peter Frumhoff. He's director of science and policy at the Union for Concerned Scientists. He was lead author on the reports from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which concluded that the planet was indeed warming and that there's a greater than 90% chance that human activity is the cause. Last month, the IPCC was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize, along with former Vice President Al Gore, for drawing the world's attention to global warming, and he joins us now. Congratulations and welcome.
Thank you very much.
And I'm wondering, Peter, just briefly, did it help that you won the Nobel, or did it hurt that, you know, to some polarizing political partisan was on the winning platform as well, you know, that Gore was there as well? Did that sort of take away a little or add?
No, I don't think it made a difference at all. I think the fact that the Nobel Peace Prize Committee sought to honor a group of scientists, 2,000 scientists, who are highlighting the state of the science and the urgency of action on this issue has really helped elevate the importance of this, both here in the United States and, of course, to the whole suite of countries that are gathering this week and next in Bali.
Well, and you are heading there. What's on the agenda?
Well, the challenge, as you mentioned at the outset, is to create a roadmap over the next 2 years. The nations of the world have to decide what comes after the Kyoto Protocol expires in 2012. And so the core challenge is to lay out the architecture, the beginning of the architecture for what they'll seek to agree to. They have 2 years. And the challenge that's most important is to ensure that the business community gets certainty, that they know that we're not going to lose a carbon market that's already set in place.
And the carbon market being?
Being the Kyoto Protocol that sets mandatory limits for those countries that have chosen to participate.
Right. And yet some would say, why not move that deadline up? Because we know that UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon returned from a fact-finding trip to Antarctica to see the ice sheets are melting. He said the world is on the verge of a catastrophe. The UN report detailed these, you know, devastating effects in the strongest language yet. So why not, you know, move the deadlines up, get going sooner?
Well, we already have a protocol in place that's setting real emissions reductions for those countries that are participating, and indeed countries that haven't yet chosen. Australia, for example, with a new prime minister, is now set to join the Kyoto Protocol. It's only the U.S. among industrialized nations that hasn't yet taken the plunge to take on real emissions reductions caps. So we already have a process in place. We need to build upon it. And indeed, we don't need to wait for the Kyoto Protocol to expire. We're seeing states, for example, in this country, already taking on emissions reductions that in many cases exceed what the protocol calls for.
Right, but without the not waiting for the federal government.
That's correct.
Which, by the way, is you know, still hammering out that energy, that energy bill that would raise the emission standards on cars. Let's talk about Bali, because one thing that may be happening there concerns the problem of deforestation. Under the Kyoto Treaty, developing nations don't get a credit if, for instance, they keep a forest from being cut down. And by credit, I'm talking about the carbon trading. Explain what that is.
Well, so deforestation accounts for about 20% of the world's emissions of carbon dioxide, which is the principal heat-trapping gas. And the way the protocol is currently structured, there's no economic incentive for countries, particularly the forest-rich countries of the developing world, to reduce their emissions. They don't get any financing coming out of it. And they're seeking to change the equation. Many of the developing countries, led by Papua New Guinea and Costa Rica, two small but very important countries in the negotiations, and soon by Indonesia.
Which is huge.
Yeah. And about 85% of its emissions come from deforestation. It's the fourth largest emitter of greenhouse gases in the world as a nation. They're seeking to actually say, we want to reduce our emissions and participate in the post-Kyoto carbon market. And put a lie to the claim that developing countries don't actually want to take emissions reduction seriously.
But you have to do something for us. You know, they're saying if we're going to stop this, we have to have some form of remuneration. Where would that come from?
It would come from the mandatory emissions reductions caps that industrialized countries are taking on. They would gain access to the market that is being created. The trade, exactly.
Yeah.
It doesn't take very much money because the value that those countries currently get for clearing their forests is very low. They just need a relatively small payment coming from a market-based approach to change that equation.
And why, remind us, why do Brazil and Indonesia clear their forests? What are they using it for?
Well, a variety of purposes. In many cases, it's small farmers who are clearing land to plant crops. In some cases, it's large companies that are clearing forests for large plantations, oil palm, for example, in Indonesia. And they're getting economic benefit out of that. And currently, that standing forest, the forest that they're clearing, has no economic value to them. So this is an attempt to use the carbon value of the forest, a value that we all benefit from by keeping it intact in forests, to change the equation, to create a financial incentive for them to say it's worth more intact than it is cleared.
And how would this organizing group, how would you monitor that?
Well, one of the real advances in our science over the last couple of years has been the improvement in satellite technology that allows us to look, for example, across the nations of the world and keep increasingly good track of what the state of a forest is. So we can, with that and other technologies, monitor the rates of change and know whether forests that are claimed to be cleared or claimed to be protected actually have been.
Now, the obvious other benefit of stopping this deforestation is that these are the trees that hold back floods, hold back erosion. We just saw Indonesia's capital, Jakarta, underwater, blamed in part. I mean, is that also part of the thinking?
Indeed. These forests are also, of course, the reservoir of the world's greatest diversity of life, the many species that live in tropical forests. So slowing deforestation can, if well designed, help prevent flooding, protect not only the carbon in those forests, but the enormous diversity of life that provides so much value to this planet.
What's your, what would make you happiest? With about a minute to go, what would make you the happiest to have happen in the first few days at Bali?
Well, what I'd love to see, which may be more of a pipe dream than an actual possibility, is for the U.S. To step forward and say we're actually willing to put forward a real emissions reductions target. We're willing to take on mandatory cuts in our emissions, mandatory caps on our emissions, along with the other industrialized nations, and to see China and India, two other major nations, follow suit. Now, that's really not going to happen. The Bush administration has said so. But the pressure from business leaders, from states, and others who are saying this is the direction we need to go, and indeed from presidential candidates of both parties, is making that position be one which is no longer tenable and will soon evaporate in the negotiations over the next couple of years.
Well, one can wish. Perhaps it's down the road. Peter Frumhoff, Director of Science and Policy at the Union for Concerned Scientists and a member of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which recently shared the Nobel Peace Prize with former Vice President Al Gore. He is heading to the conference in Bali on Wednesday. Peter, thanks for stopping here first.
My pleasure.
Okay. Tomorrow, we'll preview some issues before the Supreme Court this week, including Guantanamo Bay. You're listening to Here and Now. The Northeast Kingdom is a rural corner of Vermont that boasts some of the most beautiful landscapes in New England. That's one reason filmmaker Jay Craven likes to make movies there. He also has a knack for getting big-name stars from Hollywood to go there and work for peasant wages. John Kalish has this profile.
Some say it takes that indomitable Yankee spirit to survive the Northeast Kingdom's harsh winters. And maybe there's something in the air that makes writers and artists want to tell the world about this place. Take writer Howard Frank Mosier, for example. He's written several novels set in the Northeast Kingdom. When Mosier and his wife came here in the 1960s, they intended to spend a year or two as schoolteachers, but decided to stay on because, well, the stories their neighbors told were so darn good.
What we found was a gold mine of untold stories and people who dated back to the Prohibition era and to the Depression and had wonderful tales to tell about hardscrabble way of life that they had lived for many years and their families had lived for generations. And as a fiction writer, I simply could not get away from this place. I've tried more than once.
Three of Mosier's novels were turned into feature films by Jay Craven. The latest, Disappearances, is the story of a Vermont farmer's ill-fated attempt at whiskey smuggling during the Great Depression. Chris Christopherson plays Quebec Bill, a farmer who gets shot in the leg while trying to hijack Canadian whiskey into Vermont. Quebec Bill is accompanied by his teenage son, Wild Bill, who is actually not all that wild.
The Mounties are going to be all over us before we know it.
I hope so.
What?
If they get up to us, we're giving up on the spot. And you're going to a doctor, no stunts. You have to promise.
As long as you promise to bust me out of jail. Come on. We can't take any chances.
Christopherson is one of the marquee talents who have worked for scale in Craven's movies. The actor Michael J. Fox worked for free in Craven's first feature, Where the Rivers Flow North. Craven says big-time actors like Fox are more inclined to appear in small, independent films when they know the filmmaker will go to great lengths to get his film shown. Craven has personally screened Disappearances more than 150 times since its release in the spring of 2006.
We do the one thing we know how to do, which is to put our equipment in the back of the car and go to town halls and go to alternate venues and go to movie theaters and continue to dig deeper roots into the region.
On a weekday evening, Jay Craven screens Disappearances at the Portsmouth, New Hampshire Public Library. It is more than a year after the movie was released, but people had to be turned away because all 130 seats are filled.
This film was financed with $500,000 of contributions, people donating between $60 and $5,000, basically. And if anybody wants to invest in my next picture, you can talk to me afterwards. Or donate, for that matter, or buy our lovely DVDs.
Craven is adept at marketing, fundraising, and organizing, skills that come in handy in his quest to take his movies directly to small audiences at non-traditional venues. His foray into television was also unconventional. The idea for Craven's sitcom, Windy Acres, came from a woman he met at a screening of one of his films. Produced for Vermont Public Television, Windy Acres showed the culture clash when a high-strung New York City businesswoman moves to Vermont and falls in love with a struggling farmer. She was not very keen on her older daughter's love interest, an auto mechanic named Turkey Tatro.
The man has one leg, for God's sake. He's on parole. And Laura says he ate his wife.
Does he look like a cannibal to you? Rhetorical question.
My rhetorical answer? Yes.
Craven currently owns the film rights to the real-life story of two Vermont teenagers who murdered a couple of college professors. But it looks like his next movie may be set outside the Green Mountain State. Craven is currently developing a film based on a 1940 novel about a roadhouse stick-up that takes place below the Mason-Dixon line.
That's John Kalish reporting from Vermont. Coming up tomorrow, artist Myra Kallman. Her columns are now in book form for adults. Here and Now. Boxing, by its nature, is a violent contact sport, after all. The point is to inflict more damage in less time on your opponent than you receive in return, sometimes to the point of rendering that opponent unconscious, bloodied, battered. But boxing can also help prevent violence outside the ring. The discipline it calls for and the opportunities it offers can often be just enough to keep some young people off the streets and out of trouble. That seems to be the case at least in one boxing gym in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, run by a former cop whose motto is "Always do for the kids." Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game, visited that gym at 3rd and Ross and has this profile of the owner, Jimmy Savedic.
3rd Avenue Cafe, and it's about the boxing gym, and it's a place where we build champions in life.
Some modest champion building is going on, even as Jimmy Savedic tells me about the process. A guy who used to train in the gym downstairs is painting the ceiling of the cafe, meaning that Jimmy will pay him enough so that the guy and the daughter he's raising by himself will have rent money. The walls of the cafe are jammed with photographs of Joe Louis, Muhammad Ali, Rocky Marciano, and other champions. Savedic, who was a police officer and a homicide detective in Allegheny County for more than 30 years before he retired to the cafe, the gym, and various promotional schemes, stops in front of a photo of Roberto Duran, whom Jimmy admires because Duran could skip rope in a squatting position, and for at least one other reason.
You know, he's the only guy I know in boxing and knocked the guy's wife out. When he was first started out, he knocked the guy out, and the woman came in and jumped on his back. He knocked her out.
This is during a fight?
After the fight. After he knocked the guy out, she came in after the fight. He dumped the wife.
Besides the boxers, there are old photographs of legendary pickpockets on one wall of the cafe, a dubious lot, and a poster featuring the poet, Charles Bukowski, and more.
Here, my most famous picture in the house, Cyril Weck. Now, if you don't know who Cyril Weck is, then you don't know anything about homicides. He's the one that first called the Kennedy assassination a conspiracy. And he's right now in retirement because they're saying that he did something wrong. I just know I like him, and I just find him a pretty cool guy in Pittsburgh.
Jimmy and I end our tour at the door, which leaves us nowhere to go but out and then down the steps to the gym. Even as gyms go, this place is humble. There's room for a ring that's maybe 14 by 14 feet, a heavy bag, some free weights. If one of the boxers were to drop to do push-ups, anybody going anywhere else in the room would have to step over or around him. Inside the ropes, a heavyweight whom Jimmy calls Slava is shadow boxing.
He come down here to the gym.
Yeah.
Now, he came in here and said, "I want you to train me." I said, "Oh, God, let me guess. He's the next great white hope." Well, he came from Russia, Ukraine, Russia.
Russia.
And he came down and hit the bag. Almost fell down the steps watching him hit the bag. He's that good.
He's certainly that big. Slava is 22, and he claims he was successful as an amateur in Russia.
I got 30 fights, 28 won, 2 lost. Yeah, and my coach, the first coach over here, he told me to come down to this gym and talk to Jimmy about if I can training or whatever.
So what's next?
What's next? Try and turn pro, be a world champion.
Further conversation with Slava is precluded by work, his, not mine. Jimmy has arranged for somebody to climb into the ring with the heavyweight and hold the padded mitts with which trainers feel the fighter's punches.
I'm going to bring in the Khan. He was in prison for 20 years. He's going to hold the badge for the communists.
The Khan, to whom Jimmy Savedic refers, is actually an ex-con, a slender black man of 62 named Mehdi Muhammad, though Jimmy prefers to continue knowing him as Larry Chisholm, or Chiz.
But old Chiz, now, we have a history. We're connected at the hip.
I grew up on the Hill District area of Pittsburgh. I spent nearly 48 years of my life in and out of prisons, institutions, out of 62. Not something I'm proud of, but that's the way it was. For the most part, I started boxing when I was 10, 11. And when I reached the age of 25, I was had accomplished so much in boxing that I was ready for a title shot. And because I was out with some friends celebrating in the car with the wrong people at the wrong time with the wrong thing in the car, which was a lot of drugs, we got arrested. And when I got back out, I was 35 years old. And that went on and on and on.
At 51, Mehdi Mohammed decided he'd had enough of jail. He began supporting anti-gang initiatives and working with Jimmy Savidic to encourage youngsters to confine their fighting to the gym. And now, here he was, set to climb into the ring with a man of 22.
Are you going to get in the ring with this guy?
Yes, I'm going to work with him.
All right. You're giving away 40-odd years here.
It's a 62-year-old chronologically. But we're talking about a 25-year-old body. Unlike Jimmy.
There's a thin line between the cop and the corner. Really is. I got good breaks in my life, or I could easily fell that way. And if he would have got the great breaks, he'd have been a great cop. You know, I met a lot of guys that I went to prison, a hell of a lot more honest than a lot of the people that I met supposedly that are supposed to be the great pillars of our society.
As a promoter, self and otherwise, Jimmy Savedic acknowledges few limitations. He writes poetry. He stages not only Golden Gloves bouts, but quasi-theatrical productions. One of Jimmy's many business cards identifies him as a public relations specialist, but the banner across the top of the card reads, Bail, USA. Despite the sometimes bewildering variety of his past and present pursuits, he clings to a few simple precepts.
Tell you what, I have never yet seen a kid, nor I've wrestled, I lost count of people, ever, I've never arrested a kid with boxing gloves. And it's really tough to sit there and smoke a crack pipe with a boxing glove on.
It's a rote endorsement of boxing, but Jimmy Savedic has the experience to back it up.
First kid I arrested 30-some years ago, his little Smith boy, he's 13 years old. It was funny because he was afraid and so was I. He grabbed a kid, he scared him, chased him, he was stealing tape that from a car. Smith boy didn't make it till he was 15. He died from an overdose of drugs. That boy will always be immortal to me. He will always be 13 years old for me, and I'll always be holding the back of his belt. And I wish I could have held his belt and dragged him to a gym. I didn't do that.
Hence the cramped premises at the corner of 3rd and Ross in Pittsburgh. Though none of the young men I met that afternoon in February had been dragged to the gym, they came because they believed they had talent and that work would refine that talent into the means for providing a living.
I want to be the light heavyweight champion in the world.
Aaron Soule, 25, has only been coming to Jimmy Savedic's gym for a couple of months, but he believes he'll be ready for a title fight within 5 years.
I tried a lot of other things in life that didn't work out too well, and this is just something that I happen to enjoy doing very much. I love the game of boxing, and just something I happen to be pretty good at.
Asked to assess Aaron Soule's chances, Jimmy Savedic falls back on one of his favorite slogans. He wants everybody in his place to strive to be the champion of his or her own life.
I've watched 1,000 young men come in here, and they dream, and some of them will never be boxers. It's just not going to happen. Not everybody can be a trainer. Not everybody can be a announcer. Not everybody can be a card girl. But everybody has to be the champion of their own life.
Could you hear a little Don King in there? Maybe. King and Jimmy are both smiling in the picture of the two of them that hangs in the cafe. But in Pittsburgh, there are lots of kids and lots of people who are no longer kids who believe they're better off for having made the acquaintance of Jimmy Savedic.
Come on.
Our story on Jimmy Savedic was produced by Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. To see pictures of that gym at 3rd and Ross, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston, and we welcome our newest listeners at KSFR in Santa Fe, New Mexico. They join us today. Come on in. The weather's... well, better where you are than here. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.